listening to the Yacht Racing Life podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. I'm Justin Chisholm, and my guest this week is British dinghy sailor Andrew Mills, a one-time Olympic campaigner in the Finn class, who last month won the International OK Dinghy World Championship title on Lake Garda after topping a fleet of no less than 212 boats. If you're looking for tips on how to put together a major championship campaign of your own, then I think you'll definitely be interested in what Andrew and I discuss during our chat. First of all, congratulations on that win. A huge fleet, 220 entries. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, absolutely. Huge entry. And I think originally the Lake Garda Worlds was planned for 2020. Which was actually when I originally got an OK, kind of planning to sail a Worlds at Lake Garda. So I think it's a bucket list venue, and I guess in the OK fleet, people prepared for it in 2020, and then COVID took it away from everyone. So I guess everyone was prepared and excited for this year to come around. Huge entry.
Fantastic. Now, your sailing background, you were an Olympic campaigner in the Finn for many years. Let's just talk a little bit about that. In fact, let's go back to your beginnings in sailing. Where did it all begin for you? Was it as a youngster?
Yeah, as a youngster. So I mean, my dad is mad keen on sailing. So I think I was first thrown in a boat around 4 years old. Queen Mary Reservoir was a local club, kind of the best bit of inland water near enough London for dad to get to work and all those kind of things. Started at age four, and then guess I didn't do youth squads and things like that. I wasn't hugely involved in when I was younger, kind of did every sport under the sun growing up. And then around university time, kind of the sailing, started to become a lot more serious. And then that turned into, some full-time campaigning for 7 years after university.
So tell me about those other sports that were competing with sailing. What else were you doing? What sort of sports?
I think we did. I mean, basketball was a big one for me. Cricket, cross-country running, some other ones. But, every sort of athletics, any sport going, you name it, we had a go at it. And I think that was a bit of a family thing that just, you play all the sports available to you and, you decide which ones you like as you get a little bit older. And basketball and sailing was always a close one for me. I think I remember thinking at some point that if you're good at basketball in the UK, you're not necessarily the best on the global scale, whereas, the British sailing team is very well regarded. And if you're the best in the UK, then you probably figure somewhere fairly high on the global scale as well. So that was maybe what tipped it for me towards sailing.
What sort of classes were you sailing back then? Was it single-handers at that point, or were you doing double-handers?
Mainly single-handers, but a lot of sailing with my dad. So we had the Taser when we were younger, and as I got a bit bigger, that turned into an RS 400. So a lot of double-handed sailing with my dad, I guess up to age 16, somewhere around there. But then always single-handers alongside. So I sailed toppers for quite a while, and then into lasers. And then, fins, but I guess was always one of the larger sailors. So tended to get a bit too big for the boat before you kind of mentally were mature enough to sail it, if you like.
So you went off to university to study what?
Management sciences and accounting.
Sounds thrilling. Now, most people that I talk to on the podcast, professional sailors at least, tell me a story of, well, I was going to go to university and then I got an offer to go and work at North's or to go and do the Volvo or whatever, and they never went back to the head degree. I'm guessing that you finished your degree, did you, or is this another similar story?
No, I finished my degree. For us, getting the degree finished and kind of the education side of things was always important. And then for me, the plan was always a normal job, not a sailing job necessarily in the long run. So yeah, I sailed full time until age 28, and then since then I've traded credit default swaps, I've brokered credit default swaps and corporate bonds, and now my full time job is trading energy, so gas and power.
Okay, so very, very different. Was there anything from the Olympic campaigning that you could take into the normal work life?
I think for me, in terms of getting normal work life, I think all of my jobs have come about as a result of my sailing experience and what I've achieved there, as opposed to my educational background and degree. I think there's in the city in London, there's quite a desire for for ex-athletes and also ex-military. There seems to be a big drive for people like that, knowing that they're hardworking, objective, deal with pressure well. So I think for me, that was probably the thing that, did allow me to get the jobs that I've had after my sailing, yeah.
Now, sailing, you've not left sailing. You may not be a full-time campaigner anymore, but were you able to carry on sailing just for your own entertainment?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because I think some people see if you sail full-time for a job, maybe the passion can go a little bit. But for me, I moved into a normal job at a time where I thought, I've had an amazing 7 years of full-time campaigning. And it's not that I don't like the sport anymore. It's not the reason why I'm stopping. It's kind of, wanting to be around a bit more when you get a bit older and family and things like that. And just was kind of my plan for the future. But luckily I've still managed to very much stay in contact with a lot of people in the sailing world and still do plenty of sailing, which I'm very happy to still be involved with that and at a high level too.
So other than the OK, what other sailing do you do?
So I guess I've done a fair bit of actual sailing over the years, not doing any of that at the moment. But then most recently as well, I've been doing some 5.5-meter sailing as well. So I guess, these smaller, slower tactical keelboats where my tactical mind is a useful thing to have on board. Yeah, it's still great to do that. And nice to do some sailing, I think, as you get a little bit older. The single-handed sailing is great fun, but it's also great to be involved with a team and sort of share the racing with other people.
Did you carry on with the Finn after you stopped your Olympic campaign? I think you stopped in 2014.
Yeah, correct. 2014. I kind of made a decision at that point to stop the Finn. I mean, the Finn, it's a brute of a boat. And I think I kind of decided, if I can't be in the gym the whole time and training hard, I don't particularly want to sail against people that I maybe feel that I should be beating in a race, but they're allowed to do it more full-time than I am. And so I'm losing to them for that reason. So, I kind of made a conscious decision to stop the Finn at that point. I am approaching my 40th birthday in December, which would then make me a master in the Finn class. So who knows, at some point there could be a comeback in the Finn class to have a crack at the Masters.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another massive fleet. I recently interviewed PJ Postma about his win in the Masters. I think that was bigger than your fleet, 300 boats. That class has really just kind of gone from strength to strength away from the Olympic side of things, hasn't it?
Yeah, I say it's interesting, and I was just reading some stuff recently on the Star as well. I guess the Finn and the Star, both of them are great boats. I've only sailed the Star for maybe a week or so, but it's an awesome boat. And both brilliant boats. And I guess with the direction Olympic sailing is going now, they've kind of been pushed out of the Olympic classes. But it's great to see both classes still going incredibly strong. And I guess that's just testament to how good a boat they both are, and also the people in the class that, just want to keep sailing those boats.
So where did the OK come into your life?
Yeah, so I guess it was around coming up to the 2020 Worlds, which were planned to be in Garda. A good friend of mine, Paul Charles, had got himself a boat. And I think at this stage, since 2014, I'd not had a single hander of my own. Maybe after 6 years of full-time work, was thinking that could be quite good fun. And Paul kind of showed me the class, and I had a little sail in one. I thought, I'm probably a little bit too heavy for the class naturally, but if it's in Garda and there's a good bit of breeze, that should be in my favour. So yeah, around 2020 was the first time I got one. And then, yeah, unfortunately, that, those worlds were cancelled. But have enjoyed them since then, just sailing down at Hayling Island. We've got a reasonable little fleet of them down there. So I've sailed there. And then the 2023 Worlds happened to be in the UK. So that was my first World Championships. Yeah, and that was, I guess, a good warm-up and a good chance to learn the international fleet a little bit more before the Garda Worlds in 25.
What was your result in that Worlds?
So I came fifth at the 2023 Worlds. I have to say, I was very happy with that. It's an interesting, you know, the OK, particularly downwind, is quite a technical boat. I think with the chimes on the boat and also being a lighter boat than the Finn, kind of body weight movements fore and aft, etc., are quite powerful. And so you do see some big speed differences. So I think, there's definitely a few people that could handle that much better than me at the 2023 Worlds. And I guess I learned a fair bit there, which is, yeah, put me in good stead for 25.
The OK was, it's always been described as it was created as the training boat for the Finn, the kind of the feeder boat for the Finn. I guess if you look at the rig, there's some similarities of it, but it is quite a different boat, isn't it? As you say, it's hard chines rather than the rounded shape of the Finn. What similarities did you see between the two classes?
Yeah, I agree that the chimes make it quite a different boat downwind. I guess there's the whole development side of big similarities where you can have different boats, different manufacturers of masts, different mast bend characteristics. I guess those things are very similar. But I think even in the Finn, we did kind of, once we got good mast numbers, you know, the hull, it was always kind of, this one does appear to be faster. So everyone has this brand. So it becomes a little bit more one design-ish. I think the OK is less one design-ish. You know, I've got an Ovington hull, which I think is known for being a fast hull upwind, but definitely not necessarily the fastest hull downwind. And then there's some other hulls that, you know, seem faster on downwind, but definitely slower upwind. Yeah, in terms of sailing, you know, there are similarities, but it's not a mini-fin, that's for sure. And I guess tactically, you know, it's very similar. It's a slow boat. So, you know, tactically, lots of similarities.
So how did you take to the OK? Did you take to it immediately, or was it a little bit of a struggle? I mean, let's talk about kind of body size as well. I mean, you came from the Finn. What's the weight range that you expect for the OK?
I guess the OK. Well, I think Nick Craig is around 90 kilos, I've heard, which I say Nick being, I'm not sure if he's around 6'3" or something like that, you know, tall and 90 kilos. I think for all weather conditions, that probably is somewhere around spot on. But I think, you know, the OK, there's definitely people down to 80, 85 kilos. And then, you know, on the heavier side, you see some guys going really well upwind that you think they must be more than 110 kilos. Yeah, I would have thought 80, somewhere 86 to 100 kilos, somewhere in that range, I think, is the right range, depending on wind conditions. And I say Garda was, for me, a little bit of dieting the months before I got myself down to about 99, 100 kilos, which, you know, looks like it was pretty spot on for a windier venue, for sure.
And how tall are you?
6'3".
Yeah, so you kind of you've got some leverage going upwind then.
Yeah, it's an interesting boat because it looks like a small boat, but there's plenty of power in the rig if you really want to hike. And there's, I don't know, 13 knots plus. You know, anyone could hike as hard as they like, if you like. And I think it does reward having that leverage once the breeze is in.
All right, let's talk about the preparation for Garda. You bought the boat kind of 4 years earlier, so I guess you had a lot of time to think about Garda. So had you sailed on Garda much before, and what are the characteristics that you identified about that venue going into this event?
Yeah, so over the years I've sailed Garda, I'm going to guess maybe somewhere between 6 to 10 times in Garda before. You know, I know Garda a little bit, not super well, but a little bit. and I think is an interesting place in terms of if you're fast and you start well, it's relatively simple. Yeah, a lot of it just relies, I think, on that execution. You know, if you don't start well, then the place can kind of be a bit of a nightmare to sell a week because everybody knows which direction to go. So it's not easy, that's for sure. But I think for me, you just need to get your boat speed as high as possible going into an event like that. And then a bit of a focus on starting as well to be able to get off the line.
So what preparation did you do? I think I read in one of the reports that you'd done some training with Charlie Cumley and Matt Howard back at your local club. Was that the extent of it?
Yeah, that kind of was. Well, timing, family-wise, I had my first son that arrived late March this year. So kind of then had 2 months of no sailing and, you know, just doing family stuff and got back to the UK after some time in Italy early June. So basically had June, July and August to try to get some time in on the water, which I say we're very lucky at Hayling. Yeah, Matt and Charlie have been around and obviously from results and you know, they're known not just inside the OK class, those guys. Matt was my coach in the Finns. So they're both cracking sailors. So very lucky for me to be able to have people like that on the doorstep to sail with. And I'm guessing over those months, maybe we maybe got 10 to 14 sessions in on the water or something like that. So not loads, but you know, when you train with two other very good people, the quality is always high. That was a lot of the training. And then I guess on the physical side, just for me, quite a bit of time on the bike as well to try to get the body weight down. I dropped from 108 kilos at the start of June down to 100. So yeah, a fair bit of physical training to drop that. And then sailing with Charlie and Matt, you know, they're both a bit smaller than me. So I see where in the OK in flatter water in 8-9 knots, you know, if you're carrying another 10 kilos in the boat, you are just a bit slower for that reason. We kind of was aware how important it is to knock a few kilos off.
Yeah, that's some commitment. Eight kilos is quite a lot to drop.
Yeah, it is. I guess it comes from the days in the Finn of where, I guess body weight for me there went from a heavy wind event, you might be up at that 108 kilos, and then a light wind event, you'd probably get down to 95. So over the years, I've kind of had a bit of practice at either eating a lot or eating very little and going out on the bike.
Just let me dive into the diet side of it for a bit. When you are trying to get down to a lower weight, you're out on the bike exercising. What do you do diet-wise?
I'll be honest, for me, I think I am a big person, so obviously I can still eat a fair amount of calories and still lose weight. So for me, the biggest thing, I'll just cut out alcohol, and it's just all the snacks in between meals. So I'll just revert to there's breakfast, lunch and dinner, you know, something healthy, meat, rice and some veg for dinner, and then a bit of time on the bike, and then that will kind of bring the weight off me relatively quickly.
Yeah, I know there'll be a lot of big guys listening to this who are who'll be interested in just knowing what the secret is to do that. Now, you mentioned that the training sessions you do there, it's easy to kind of gloss over that and say, yeah, you were training with some good guys. But how exactly did you structure those training sessions? You know, there'd be people listening to this who would be interested to know how to get the best out of some kind of joint training sessions.
Yeah, I guess the main thing that you can do is speed work, you know, in terms of practicing starting three boats is not really enough. I've done the odd session in Hayling myself just in the harbour, you know, just approaching boys and practicing trying to hold station next to them, things like that, to just do a little bit of, I guess, slow down speed boat handling. But most of our sessions, that, to be honest, we'll go out into the bay. We'll set out tuning runs with a rabbit run to start and then a tuning run. But I think it's just, you know, Matt and Charlie are very good friends. Matt, I know very well through my Finn days, and I know Charlie well. But I think just the three of us are quite open as well. So people are quite willing to do a tuning run and say, someone was fast. And, you know, if someone might say, I think you looked a little bit slow for this reason. And I think it's actually just a nice, There's no ego. No one's out there going, oh, I'm fast. I'm not going to tell people why I was going fast. It's just quite an open session. But yeah, we'll generally just do tuning runs upwind and then downwind, just try to find a buoy out there in the bay somewhere that's downwind, practice the downwind, and then again, just, you know, frank discussions about, oh, I think I was going quite nicely for this reason, or someone saying maybe I was a bit slow for this reason. Yeah, and I guess a lot of training over the years is watching other people as well whilst you're training and seeing, ah, they're going a bit quicker, and do you know what, they're sailing bigger angles downwind, or they're a bit more active with their main sheet, or, you know, fang tension, that kind of thing. So yeah, no rocket science formula, if you like, but I guess just a lot of focus on speed. And probably, I guess, for the three of us, if speed is good, we've all done enough sailing that we kind of know our tactics and strategy is generally good enough. So yeah, that's kind of the bulk of the sessions.
And were you guys all using similar or identical equipment?
I think so. I think everyone's got Ovington boats out of the three of us, and then Matt has a different type of mast. I think he's a SeaTech mast, and then myself and Charlie have Kaylee masts, and then everybody on North Sails, which I say seems to be a good combo. I think in particular that's a very good upwind combo. Some people might say there's some other bits of kit that are maybe slightly faster downwind, but I think we probably all run off the logic of, if you can get to top mark in the top few, then that's going to lead to a good race. Yeah, it's all well and good saying you're fast downwind, but if you arrive at the top mark in 30th, you know, there's a lot of work to do to get back to the front of the fleet.
Yeah. And just for my information, in the OK class, you're running an all-purpose sail, or do you have light wind and heavy wind sails?
So for me, I'm just running one sail. I've just got the North, it's the Cat 2. I think the deeper sail that North make, basically. Yeah, just with me being a little bit bigger, and then I take a little bit of luff curve out of that just to make that a tiny bit flatter for how I like it. But yeah, I think for me that's, I know I'm fine with a deeper sail once it gets breezier, and then a little bit more power in the medium winds is obviously good to have a deeper sail. And then, yeah, I guess that sail will be a little bit trickier setting up in lighter winds. But yeah, I think I just stick with that one sail, and yeah, that one seems to work fairly well for me.
All right, let's talk about the boat itself. You said it's an Ovington. Did you buy it new in 2021?
So actually, I bought one new in 2020, and then the boat that I had for the Worlds in Garda, that one was, I did a sort of part exchange and upgraded to another new one. So that boat was actually only a couple of months old. Just got the new, I changed the sort of the side deck position slightly to a sort of a slightly different way of hiking. Which seemed fairly nice and all worked quite well for me. So it's a standard Ovington boat, but it was a new one, which I think the boats last very well. I don't think I feel any different from the boat that was 5 years old to a new one, but who knows, a little bit of extra stiffness in a windy venue can probably always be a positive thing.
There's a lot of rope on the OK in the similar way to the Finn. Can you just talk us through what controls are the most important for you while you're actually racing? What are you adjusting most?
Yeah, I think, upwind, I'll probably play in haul and out haul is relatively set, I guess, especially in those windier days. And for me, with a deeper sail, quite often, you know, you'll put a crease in the outhaul and tighten up the bottom of the sail, knowing that there's still a good bit of depth, you know, made in the sail already. So in-haul and out-haul, I'm not adjusting hugely. But then down-haul through the gusts will be kind of played. So, you know, when the gusts come in, I will be looking to pull that on to make the boat accelerate forwards. But, you know, any lulls, especially with me being a little bit bigger, I will be dropping the out-haul off. And then aside from that, just sheet tension, because I guess the big difference with the OK and the Finn is the Finn once it gets to a certain breeze, you do tend to pull boom down to deck, whereas the OK, you never really do that. And so there is just a bit more kind of tuning to try to keep that perfect leech tension. So I would say main sheet tension is the main thing upwind that you're trying to get spot on the whole time. And then downwind, I mean, releasing outhaul and inhaul to try to get a bit of depth in the sail. Downhaul, obviously, coming off. But kicker is, I adjust the kicker a lot. You know, every time a little gust comes in, you'll feel that, yeah, a bit more kicker needs to come on. And then the second that drops off a little bit, kicker off. So that kicker tension is adjusted a lot. Yeah. But so downwind, just kicker and main sheet is the main thing, really.
And what are you looking at on the sail? Are you looking at, or is it just instinctive that you know you can feel the boat, or are you looking at anything specific to give you that accuracy of the trim?
I think so. I mean, upwind, you'll tend to get, I think if your sheet tension is too high, the telltales further up the sail in the top kind of quarter will start to stall. So, you know, if you want to have a telltale to look at, it's probably those ones higher up the sail will be the correct place to look. Myself, you know, largely it is feel. You know, you let out a couple of clicks on the ratchet block and you feel that there's a bit more depth in the sail. You feel the power come back. So I wouldn't say I'm looking up there much, but that would be the place to look. And then downwind, again, it's a bit of a feel thing. I think you can feel when there's too much fang, the boat feels a little bit dead, whereas it's a little bit too loose, it feels like it might get nearer towards a death roll. And, you know, you're trying to find that right mix of a bit instate, you know, a little bit of instability, but enough, you know, not too much. But I guess just looking at the leech of the sail, you can kind of see if your battens, if everything looks very flat, you know, that doesn't look nice. Whereas you kind of want your battens, oscillating around a bit in the breeze and flicking a bit. Yeah, looking at your leech would be the main indicator.
And the windward heel on the OK, does it pay to sail in those medium winds with as much windward heel as in the fin? I mean, which was pretty pronounced, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think especially up the wind range, you know, you'll sail with, I mean, I guess the answer is you should sail enough windward heel that the rudder is just perfectly balanced is really what you're looking to do. But I think the big thing now that you'll see with everyone is people sailing angles downwind. So, you know, and then it's important that when you sail those angles, you know, if you're turning up to a kind of more broad reachy angle, you know, you don't want to be doing that by pushing the rudder, the tiller away. You want to be doing that by moving body weight to leeward. So the boat naturally just turns to that angle and vice versa when you're bearing the boat away. So I think there's just a lot of body weight moving to keep the rudder as neutral as possible, but to allow you to sail the angles that you want to sail.
Is that a change in the class? What's driven that?
Well, I say, I'm not sure. I mean, the OK originally, you see lots of photos of people standing up downwind. I mean, I'll be honest, for me, that's just, you know, what you would do in the fin. And then that's just kind of something that I've taken across to the class. The way that I view is the fastest to get the boat downwind. I think, yeah, gone are the days where pointing the boat directly downwind and sort of getting everything nicely in balance gets you down fast. You know, especially if there's waves around, sailing broad reaches or by the lee to generate a bit more apparent breeze gives you more power and allows you to kind of punch through waves and jump to the next wave. I think that's where most of the speed gains downwind come.
Fantastic. So let's talk about the regatta itself. What were the range of conditions that you experienced over the event?
So I said, from I think a few days before I arrived, there were a few light wind days, but from when I arrived, I think every afternoon we had somewhere 12 to 20 knots every day from, say, 3 days before the event, and then for Monday and Thursday of the event, and then the Friday was a bit different. I guess we got an 8-knot race in there. The kind of the southerly aura breeze just didn't seem to get going that day. But in general, the conditions were brilliant, which was great. Because I mean, September, a few people say Garda can not be classic Garda, if you like. But I think that, you know, we were very lucky that we did get classic Garda. And I think great for, you know, chatting to Aussies and Kiwis that, you know, it was a bit of a bucket list event to come and do something in Garda. It's great for people that have come from the other side of the world to turn up, and they get the proper Garda, and, you know, they all thought it was absolutely stunning. It's nice when everyone makes that effort to come to an event that you actually get the wind that, you know, it's renowned for.
Yeah, absolutely. I know the Moth class suffered quite badly from it not being normally like this here in Garda when they did their championships. I interviewed Enzo Ballinger recently, who won, and he said, yeah, it was very different to what they expected. They raced in the northerly breeze as much as in the southerly breeze. Did you end up with any northerly?
So the northerly breeze was there in the mornings, but we didn't, I think, because we never fell behind on races. I think they always race in northerly once you've fallen behind, if you like, and if the southerly doesn't look great. And I've raced in northerly before. I mean, I quite like it because I think it is relatively reliable. The downside is that I think you normally have a 7 a.m. start, so it's a little bit less sociable for everyone if they want to go and have dinner and a few beers the night before.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what's the detail behind your scoreline? Because you won a lot of races. If you just look at the scoreline, it looks like you cruised it. But reading the reports, I think it was a lot tighter than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The scoreline looks very impressive, but that definitely doesn't tell the true story. I think so, you know, being so many boats, we're in three fleets. So you always get this thing, the more fleets you've got after those first six races, the points are still incredibly close. So, you know, I guess you can look at every time you get a second, you've effectively got a sixth position, you know, not a second position. So, I kind of really went in there with thinking that, you know, every single point that you can minimize in those first six races is worth a lot, and also not using up a discard in those first six races is very important as well. So I think those first six races, I did get a yellow flag in the race that I got a second in, which was a little bit disappointing. So that kind of, I was leading that one, so I was almost able to get the perfect scoreline aside from that yellow flag, but that was what it was. But I did have one start in particular that I did struggle to get off the line. But I guess I had my little bit of luck there in that I was at the committee boat, and sometimes you kind of look and there's just the perfect spot to tack out, and you duck a boat and you think, hang on, I'm the first boat onto port here and I'm off to the correct side of the course. And actually that probably turned into one of the easier races for me, from one of my worst starts. Yeah,
I want to get into the starting in a bit of detail. Just before we do, the yellow flag, just for those who are not familiar with on the water umpiring, that was for I'm guessing Rule 42.
Yes, so it was Rule 42. Which part of it, I'm not sure. I'll be honest, I don't I never intend to break the rule. So, you know, I know they do put up on the notice board, they'll put up what they gave you the yellow flag for, but I say I never intend to get done for breaking one of those rules, so I don't tend to like to look, because I don't want to put something in my head to do more or less of something. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure which rule it was, but as I say, they gave me, that was on the last reach, the second to last reach, the going across to the outer loop.
So on the starting, what was your strategy going into this? Because these are, even though they split you into flights, they're still big fleets, aren't they?
Yeah, still 70 boats. So I do remember, the practice race, if we went to check, I'd do the practice race to get an idea on how much bias they'd put on the line. Because I think, you know, everyone knows Garda is generally go right. So they'll often start with a bit of pin end bias, and it's working out. Is that bias big enough to start at the pin or halfway down the line and kind of tack and get straight across the fleet? Or do you still need to start the committee boat and tack? And so starting wise, yeah, the practice race, I kind of had an average start and just tried to be fairly close to the committee boat. But at 2.5 minutes to go, there's a kind of wall of boats that were all there at the committee boat already. Yeah, it wasn't the nicest place to be. So I guess for me, they were always putting a bit of PNM bias on the line. If you like, the riskiness of your start, the further down to the pin you went, the lower the risk was, which if you felt you had good boat speed and you could get clear and tack, it was a less risky route, which may get you to the top mark in the top five, let's say. But yeah, your chance of being in 35th at the top mark was much lower. So I think that was kind of a big part in my decision making. And then I probably a lot of midline starts. And then in Garda, normally you can get some kind of transit. So if you can get that transit and start with a boat length jump on the guys around you, then you can roll into the tack when you need to. And then for me, it was mainly just let the boat speed do the talking and kind of get across that right-hand side.
And in the OK, is it an easy boat to control in those downspeed moments leading into the start? What are you doing in particular just to help you position yourself?
Yeah, not as easy as the fin, I'd say, because obviously it weighs less. So the second you get downspeed, the chance of the boat going backwards increases. I think the rudder size as well is smaller than the fin. So the fin, you know, if you gave the rudder a good waggle, you could get the boat out of irons, no problem. The OK is a lot less like that. So yeah, generally trying to keep the boat a little bit more speed on. And I think for me, when you see people waiting at the committed boat with 2.5 minutes to go, you know, it's not the sort of boat where you can just hold station for that long. But the fact that people are trying it means that you know, your gap is taken. You can't get in there. So I mean, yeah, just trying to keep a bit of speed on, and I mean, all the normal stuff of just, you know, a bit of a gap to leeward. And then I think, you know, the big thing for me is always if you have a transit, it's not giving away that you have a transit to the boats near you. You kind of wait till 10 seconds to go and then just accelerate, and everyone else will be shocked that you've gone already, but you've got your transit so that you know you're safe.
How do you not give it away? Do you mean by not constantly looking at it, or?
You'll see some people with a transit and they go and sit on the line very early, if you like, whereas I think if you're in a group and you know you're 5 boat lengths back, you know, till 20 seconds, you stay with the group. But then at 20 seconds to go, you accelerate and you just sail off, and everyone's sort of looking at you like, hang on, he's going to be early, but you've got your transit. I think it's, yeah, you just don't want to give away that kind of advantage that you've got by having a good transit.
Okay, so you're off the line cleanly. You're wanting to go right, so you're looking for that first opportunity to tack and cross. Is that the strategy?
I think in Garda that pretty much was the strategy generally, and generally you could see that everyone was looking to do the same thing. I think, you know, you see a lot of people that are immediately looking over their shoulder and trying to pinch off the person to windward, but then they're sailing very bad VMGs whilst they're doing it. So I think a lot of people forget that your boat needs to be moving, you know, at 100% VMG the whole time. So for me, it's, you know, if you like, you just straight in, head into the boat, sailing as fast as you can. And then at some point, you have a quick look over your shoulder. If the tack's on, you go for it. If it's not quite, then I'll never be one to start aggressively pinching, if you like, to try to force the tack. You know, just need to sail faster until that gap comes. And as I say, and Garda's one of those places where I think 99% of the fleet know that everyone's looking to get the tack in anyway. The second the person on your windward hip can tack, they normally will. But again, I think it's also, I will not rush to just push the tiller away, if you like, because at the same time, if you can get yourself 5 boat lengths to leeward of you on your port tuning run, then that means that you've actually got a clear lane and you can go fast. Yeah, so that, you know, there's no need to super rush into that attack. Yeah, need to be prompt, but not too fussy about it.
So during this event, how often were you in the top 4 or 5 at the windward mark?
I think those first 4 days, I would have been in the top 4 or 5 every race. I don't think there's anywhere where I wasn't. But I think a lot of that is probably just off kind of straight line boat speed, if you like. And I guess I am, I say, approaching 40, but probably still at the younger age of the the average age of the okayed sailors, if you like. So you kind of see it, I guess, on day 2, 3, and 4 when people are a bit tired and halfway up the beat, the hiking intensity is dropping a bit from most people. And luckily, I can still maintain that. I think a lot of good straight line boat speed. And then I guess the other interesting thing with Garda, which I made mistakes on in the practice race, but it was kind of a good mistake because it made me aware of it, but people overlaying on starboard lay line, because there's a lot of people don't want to tack until they're on the lay line. But then if the right hand bend in the wind comes in, that obviously the bend gets bigger as you go up the course. So if you look like you're on lay when you tack, then you're actually over lay line. And so I think it's probably a lot of people that gave away quite a few boats in that respect as well, which I think I managed to do quite well at not getting that wrong.
Are you working the boat physically, body, other than hiking, just kind of working the boat in the same way as we see in the fin?
Yeah. Upwind, a lot of similarities to the fin. I guess the boat weighs less, so physical movements that you do don't need to be quite as powerful. And I guess in some ways a little bit less physical, because the fin was so big and heavy that it would take a huge wave to really knock the boat, if you like. So you could actually focus on just hiking really hard. Whereas with the okay, I always think your steering over the waves is actually a bit more crucial, because you can hike really hard, but if a wave hits you and kind of knocks you too far off the wind, it doesn't have the weight and the momentum, so it will stop. So, but I think precision of steering is actually probably a little bit more critical in the okay than in the fin. So in that respect, you can ease off the physical side a little bit. But if you can hike hard and, body movements at the right time over waves, then that definitely does help the speed as well.
So it sounds like you must have made gains downwind, I'm guessing. Was that what happened?
I think generally, versus Nick, for example, in times when I was close to him on downwinds, I'd say our speeds were similar. But I think I did manage to have a lot of top mark roundings in good positions, leading quite a lot of top mark roundings. And then I guess I always think if you're going to win a championship, you need to be in a position where if you're around the top mark first, you should generally be allowed, be able to sail away from the fleet and increase your lead slowly, which I think I did generally manage to do. You always get a bit the certain guys that are faster upwind arrive in second, third, fourth, fifth at the top mark, but they may be a bit slower downwind. So they may slow down the guys in 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th who could be fast downwind, for example. But if they have to fight to get through the first four boats, then, that will really slow them down. So, generally I was able on the downwinds to move away and increase the lead.
And your strategy downwind, what is it? What are you looking to achieve?
I mean, no set strategy. I mean, sailing in the on the correct board, if there's been wind shifts, sailing in the biggest pressure. But I think also there was a little bit of just sailing with some space is important. As I say, especially when everyone's doing, a bit of steering angles downwind, it's important to be able to go up and down when you want to for your set of waves that you're sailing at that point in time. Not dictated by, I can't run by the lee at the moment because there's someone on my leeward side. So generally, just if you could get a bit of space, that's a positive thing.
So let me try that again. Sorry. So over the whole regatta, when you look back on this now, what are the two or three key things that you feel like delivered your victory from your performance?
I would say straight line speed, definitely upwind in particular, downwind less so. And then I think in Garda as well, the physical side is also very important. I think, come the first day of Gold Fleet racing, still in a position where, I'm tired, but I can put in the work to try to kind of propel the boat forwards. So I think probably those two things together. And then maybe, I mean, should probably add in starting as well, because luckily starting went really well. But yeah, if I hadn't have started well, then I don't think I would have been anywhere near the positions that I were. So starting straight line speed and a bit of the physical side of things, probably the key three things for me.
How did you manage yourself on shore? Were you able to enjoy the event? It's a big event with lots of people, and it's a very sociable class, isn't it? Were you in bed at 9:30 every night, or did you manage to enjoy yourself?
Yeah, no. I mean, I enjoyed myself, I guess, probably maybe less on the beers, for example, than some of the other people. But I had, for me, I had my wife and my son with me, and then for the first time in a long time, I had my parents with me at a big event, and then also my parents-in-law, the other set of grandparents were there for the first few days as well. So we were kind of there for a big family holiday. So if you like, after sailing was a quick beer by the boats and a quick chat with some of the guys, and then a bit of family time and a barbecue at home or something like that, and a one glass of wine. And we were in bed by 10:30, let's say, reasonably early nights.
Sounds like a good combination. So listen, congratulations again on the victory, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been really interesting. I'm a single-handed sailor myself, and I'm kind of eyeing the okay in Mallorca. There's a fleet that sprung up here, so it's been really interesting to pick your brains. And I'm sure anybody who's sailing lasers or fins or okays or any other single-handed boat will be interested to hear it. So thanks for doing all that, and congratulations, and good luck for whatever comes next.
Thank you very much, Justin. Appreciate it. And pleasure to come and talk.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview. But in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.